Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You mean the real Moses. The real Moses sat down.
The real M-O-S-E-S. That is his name.
And he wrote it, or it's the...
The big Mo himself.
With in Hebrew, on paper, or something equivalent. Maybe not paper, but you know, sheepskin or whatever.
Yeah, I think he had his laptop, actually.
How confident can we be in the historicity and authorship of the Bible? Professor Matthew Thomas explains on Almost Good Catholics. Welcome to Almost Good Catholics, a conversation about theology and apologetics. I'm your host, Chris Odinets, and I will be asking interesting people who have thought about the big questions to share their conclusions, to explain what we know, how we know it, and why we think we know it. I hope this format in relationship and dialogue and back and forth may help us approach the truth and to have a really good time doing it. If you should want to take the conversation a step further, I invite you to please email almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com. Today's guest, Matthew Thomas, is Assistant Professor of Biblical Studies and Theology Department Chair at the Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology, which is part of UC Berkeley's Graduate Theological Union, where he teaches the Old and New Testaments, Patristics, and Biblical Languages. He completed his doctorate of philosophy in theology at the University of Oxford and wrote his dissertation about how the writings of St. Paul were understood in the second century, which has been published as a book as well, and also recently called by Father Stephen DeYoung of the Whole Council blog, easily the most important work in Pauline studies and likely in biblical studies as a whole of the current decade. He met his wife at Regent College in Vancouver, where they were both taking the same Hebrew class, and now the couple has four children, all of whom are also aspiring theologians. So welcome, Matthew, for being part of this podcast and for joining me for our second episode ever, and I think it will be a good one.
Thank you very much, Chris. Just so you know, it is possible that those aspiring children will come and break through the door at any point. So if that happens, I will alert you.
Good. I will have some questions ready for the.
they're pretty good at them. My daughter, she's the oldest one, Camille. She's incredible, and
how old is Camille?
She's seven. She has the most incredible theological questions, and so she asked me. This was a few months back. She was asking me if when Pharaoh's son died because of Pharaoh's sins, whether or not there was some kind of redemptive value in his death, because he, of course, is dying for his own father's sins. He's not dying for his own kind of sins. And I just thought, that's an incredible question. I love that. And we probably talked for like 10, 15 minutes about it. And we kind of came to, there probably in some way, there was probably some sort of grace involved with that. Yeah. If God recognizes all sort of like vicarious suffering as, you know, being in some way significant, that there's probably something significant to that as well, even if we can't necessarily spell out from the text, like how that exactly all went and worked. She's just incredible. She blows me away. She's better than I am, and she's seven. So,
yeah. Well, all right. possibly future guest. But tell us about yourself. Tell us about yourself and how you came to be a theologian.
Yeah, so I'm from the East Bay area here in California. And, it's a surprise that I do the kinds of things that I do because, I'm not from a Christian background or anything like that. I didn't have a Christian family growing up, but became a Christian at a pretty young age. I was nine, and made a really big impact in my life with the kind of background that I had growing up. And so the faith has been something that's been really important to me since then, and just knowing the difference that can make in your actual real life and everything. And so I didn't originally go to school to study theology. I went to Pepperdine for undergraduate and was doing political science, international studies, things like that. And felt a pretty strong call to go into ministry work. And so I ended up, after graduating, left all that and went into working in an inner city ministry in Oakland, working with basically ran an after school program for kids there at this place called Harbor House Ministries, which is just great ministry, which is still running today. And was doing that, running an after school program and then teaching scripture as part of that. And it was just a fantastic place to be able to serve and to be able to kind of share what God had given to me and done in my life through some difficult kinds of contexts and situations from when I was younger and growing up, and to be able to serve and for kids who are going through kind of analogous experiences and everything. So that was fantastic. And honestly, I'm still surprised that I'm not doing that to this day, because it still is such a big part of our lives. And it's hard to, when I was doing it, it's hard to imagine anything else. But at that point, I was teaching the Bible every day over there, and I'd starting to learn biblical Greek. And there's so many things in scripture that I felt like, I didn't really understand fully in English. And then when I started looking at it in Greek, I'm like, oh, that totally makes sense. That answers this question. I never really understood this passage. And then you look in the original language and it's like, this is great. So I was doing this on my own just because I loved it. And it was part of the teaching that I was, doing for these kids in Oakland. And I was like, well, maybe I should, learn more about this and, kind of put whatever academic gifts God has given me and try to put into use in this area. And so I ended up going to grad school up at Regent College in Vancouver, which is an incredible place. And that's where my wife and I met in that Hebrew class. And I've basically just kind of been pursuing the things that God has opened up. And so, the book that I wrote there, it came out of a paper that I wrote, just my first year, over at the school there, which was itself rooted in some of the questions that I had come from working in Oakland, just in that kind of context. And I've just continued to follow the sorts of things that, the doors that have opened. And so, there's a door to open to go do this doctoral work in Oxford. And so went and, pursued that with the research that I was doing, which I kind of stumbled across a bunch of stuff that seemed to be helpful for New Testament studies that a lot of New Testament scholars just hadn't had an opportunity to really consider, and some of what they were doing with interpretation of St. Paul. And I had the door open to come back here and be teaching in Berkeley. And so it's honestly, it's a huge surprise for me, but I'm grateful because I love this material. I love what I do. And I think it's just on your kind of practical lived, real life basis. I know how big of a difference and how much this means in my life and the lives of people around me and stuff. So it's just a joy and an honor to be able to serve in this kind of way.
Well, that's perfect. It's a beautiful story, and it shows me, for one thing, that you're exactly the person I want to ask these questions to. you say, we know the Bible is written in Greek, but we also know that Jesus was speaking in Aramaic.
Yeah.
How was it recorded? Well, let me back up.
Yeah.
First, I'm going to share my half-educated view of the Bible, and then you correct it, and we'll start talking about the New Testament.
That sounds fantastic.
So the Old Testament is the recorded summary of many centuries of oral tradition. And I mean, I'm under the impression that these ancient stories were written down long after they were composed, like an epic saga, like Homer's Iliad or Odyssey. while by comparison, the New Testament is almost a work of journalism, let's say, written by people who are eyewitnesses or the students of eyewitnesses, intimately acquainted with the events they describe.
Hmm.
The implication here is that a Christian need not defend the historicity of Noah's Ark or the harsher pronouncement of God wiping out some rival tribe of the Hebrews, right? And the, however, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ is both truth and fact, the defining event of our faith. So yeah. Is that right?
No, that's great. So that's a great starting point. So we can start with the New Testament one first.
Okay.
Because yeah. I think with what you said with respect to the New Testament, I think that that is accurate largely. And I think that that's something where, regardless of whether one is operating within, a faith-based, academic context or an academic context, which is trying to bracket kind of existential faith commitments, et cetera, that's still generally what is regarded as being accurate in that these documents are written down either within the lifetimes or within living memory of those who were active in the participants in what was actually going on. So in that sense, while you wouldn't necessarily call them, journalism as a genre, they are, that's actually not a bad way to go and to look at it in that it is reporting what are either current events or reporting events that, were current within the living memory of those who went and wrote them. When it comes to the Old Testament, I actually think that the healthiest thing that one can have here is a healthy dose of agnosticism, and that might be sort of a strange thing that to hear from a biblical scholar saying, hey, be agnostic, or at least try to cultivate this. But when it comes to the Old Testament, the nature of the evidence that we have is such that it can be really reasonably argued and interpreted in a pretty wide variety of ways. And there's people that I know and scholars that I know who, are very intelligent, both those who, profess to, hold to, traditional, faith and those who don't, who have really widely varying views as far as when were these things actually written down. And if they were written down, say, at a more recent date, and not, far off, what kind of sources were they making use of? Were they themselves making use of things that predated them? How do you get to all that? I think that from a standpoint, if you're thinking of, hey, this, we're on the Almost Good Catholic podcast. I think that one can be, an almost good Catholic and actually hold to a pretty wide range of views for how the Old Testament itself goes and comes into existence, or you can say the age of the documents themselves. So how far do they go back to? I think that you can do that faithfully because the evidence is such that it can just be interpreted quite reasonably in a number of different ways. And so I know people who I regard as faithful and very intelligent who hold to much more traditional positions, either something like Mosaic authorship or something close to that, in some way that Moses is involved in a process of authorship. And I know people who
real Moses. The real Moses sat down.
The real Moses. That is his name.
And he wrote it, or it's
the big Mo himself.
Within Hebrew, on paper or something equivalent. Not paper, but sheepskin or whatever.
Yeah, I think he had his laptop actually. I new evidence of ancient Egyptian laptops has come to light, and I believe that's the most recent theory, is that it was ancient Egyptian laptop.
It explains why there's a bite out of this apple.
Yeah, exactly. So what's interesting is if one is looking at the way that memory is preserved throughout history, and that's when we're getting to really, really ancient history, that's tough because it's almost always stuff that's very fragmentary. But when we're looking at the earliest preserved memories that we have of Moses, they always preserve it as Moses was a writer. He was a writer. And that's not something that you necessarily go and say about everybody, or that is preserved for every kind of figure, which is, in a sense, distinct about Moses, that he was a writer. So that's at least the way that he was remembered. Well, then how does that work in relation to what we have in the book of Genesis, Exodus, all these other ones? And does it necessarily mean that, you know, we have Moses at his laptop going through the desert, and, you know, well, he's stuck for 40 years going out there and just thinking like, well, I gotta do something. We're stuck here for 40 years.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, because again, there's all kinds of ways you can put this together as far as, it's very, very possible that what you have in, you know, different instances. So say you're talking about the authorship of the Pentateuch, is that you have later authors who are compiling or putting together, things that are preserved from earlier generations. And it's possible that there are things that are, in a sense, historical updatings to go and to translate into what is going to be intelligible within that period. So there's all kinds of ways that you can go, and I think faithfully put together that data. What I would say I have less sympathy for, I have less sympathy for those who are really dogmatic on things that we just, I don't think are, have a strong, and clear and consistent rational basis to be dogmatic about. And so, and this goes in both directions. So I think you can have those who are, you know, maybe a bit sort of like overly presentist or modernist in the way that it's whatever is the latest thing in historical scholarship, that this must be the truth. This must be the right thing. Therefore, this all, we know this comes from the 6th century, the 5th century, whatever happens to be. I think that if you have a wide range, if you look at biblical scholarship over the centuries, you can see how whatever the latest theory is, it tends to be good for about 45 minutes. And that's, and it's just, yeah, that's just the way that shifts,
yeah,
you know, happen. And so you don't want to have myopia and to only be able to see what the most recent.
I really appreciate that humility of this is, yeah, what we have, and we just can't say too much, but we can say,
exactly,
some things.
Yeah, so you don't want to be myopic in that direction and thinking that, you know, oh, we absolutely know and we're dogmatic about whatever the latest idea is absolutely what it happens to be. Nor do you want to be dogmatic, I think, in the other direction and say, I know that Moses had a laptop. I, yeah, just know it. I'm positive. I went and I did the work on Hebrew and I saw that there was actually the word for laptop back there. And so I can go in and say, because I think even those who are, I guess you can say, most traditionally minded and, you know, want to be most faithful to the tradition of the church, I think that you still have to recognize that there's a lot of unknowns that are there and there's a lot of good scholarly questions that are asked. And so when we're dealing particularly with things that are, you know, older in the Old Testament, I think that we have to, in a sense, be at peace and be satisfied with our own, you know, our own relative ignorance or lack of knowledge, because we're dealing with really, really ancient stuff. When we're dealing with more recent books of, you know, in the Old Testament. So if you're saying, for instance, you know, my wife and I, we wrote the commentaries from the Ignatius Study Bible on the books of 1 and 2 Maccabees. Those ones are in a different category, because they are relatively speaking from such a more recent historical period. And so you can actually date those books with a, you know, pretty good range of confidence, you know, perhaps, you know, like a 30 year kind of range or a 50 year range. And so, speaking generally, the closer that you get in history to where we are, the more evidence that we have preserved historically to be able to say with confidence, we know this fits within this range.
I think that makes sense. Can you tell us about the 1st century? Or do you want to talk about Maccabees first? I don't want to interrupt.
Oh no, that's totally fine. I was just going to say, if you're thinking with what we have in Maccabees, so, you know, the events that are going to take place is around, you know, 165 BC. We have a lot of historical context preserved from that period. And so we can date these things pretty easily. And that holds true as well for the books of the New Testament in general. You know, it's not hard and fast, but, in general, we can date these things within a pretty reasonably small range, and it's just as you go back farther within history, this gets more and more difficult because there's just less history preserved around there. You know, if these, if we're going all the way back, we're getting close to, you know, prehistoric times, and guess what? In prehistoric times, there's no recorded history. Yes. So we don't really know. And so because of that, you can make any theory that you want to. You can throw out pretty much anything. You like, hey, Moses wrote this on his laptop. And the thing is, it's hard to disprove it in the sense that it's hard to disprove anything when you're talking about really, really ancient history, because there's such fragmentary evidence that we're going by.
Okay, so 2,000 years ago, Jesus walked among us, spoke in Aramaic, people saw him by the thousands. How did that end up into this New American Bible Revised Edition in English sitting on my table over here? How did it get from how did it get from there to Saint Jerome, who wrote it down in Latin, who read Hebrew in Bethlehem but had these Greek sources? And how did the Aramaic turn into Greek, and how did they keep that Greek for those first 100 years? Are there early copies? What's the earliest copy of the Gospel of John, for instance, that, you know, somebody can say this is the Gospel of John and this is the year that somebody wrote it down?
Chris, you're gonna have me here all day. You're gonna have your listeners here all day. Well, you can't.
I don't have all day, but I would love to do it again. I'd love to do it again next week and next month or whatever you got.
Yeah, I just want you to know how dangerous it is to ask a nerd questions.
That's
like
perfect.
This, I can just go on for forever. So let's start with what you're saying with Aramaic, because I think that's an interesting one, because it is often brought in that, you know, Aramaic is kind of the previous lingua franca. If you're going back to, you know, when you have the Babylonian exile, then Persia goes and takes over, Aramaic kind of becomes that original lingua franca before Alexander the Great, before they take over. And because you have, you know, the Jews over there within the Babylonian captivity, and then within that sphere of influence, Aramaic, which is closely related to Hebrew, goes and takes over as this is the language that people can go into speak from different people groups. And so a Jew speaking Hebrew is not going to, you know, sort of Persian overlord isn't going to be able to do that one quite as easily. But or again, if it's not necessarily a political thing, just for trade, commerce, etc., Aramaic is that language of communication. So you have both Hebrew and Aramaic around in that period, and Aramaic is still, I guess you could say, at your popular ground level, is the most common spoken language within Jesus' day. However, you had Alexander the Great, and when Alexander the Great, around 300 BC, when he goes and takes over everything, and then just suddenly dies, what happens is that Greek language and culture goes and spreads everywhere. And so what Aramaic had kind of been within previous centuries, Greek had increasingly gone and taken over. And so it was that language that, you know, people use to conduct commerce and to go and to speak between different, you know, people groups and language groups, more so than Aramaic. Aramaic itself was now fairly localized within, you know, places like Palestine. And so it is actually interesting the way that Jesus, you know, he's recorded as speaking Aramaic. It situates him within a specific, you know, geographic region and time. There's a sort of specificity to the, you know, to the incarnation and what's happening. At the same time, you have other languages that are, you know, active that people are using all the time. And so you have Hebrew as kind of the cultural inheritance, particularly of the Jews, which is still active. But more than that is Greek. And this is actually my, when I was a master's student, this is what the question that I focus on is the use of Greek within Palestine at the time of Jesus. And what's remarkable is really how pervasive Greek language and culture was, and in Christ's own time, just throughout, you know, the Galilee region, and then even down into Jerusalem. This is one of the just kind of interesting sort of random facts that I've always remembered as just an illustration of how pervasive Greek was in this period. If you look within funerary inscriptions within the kind of area of Judea, so around Jerusalem, so you're kind of your center of Jewish, you know, thought, culture, and the place that you're most likely to get Hebrew as, you know, predominant. Even within Christ's own time, you know, kind of first century, the majority of funerary inscriptions that are written aren't themselves written in Hebrew.
Huh.
They're written in Greek. So it's everywhere.
I'm appealing to the more learned kind of, you know, like this is the, I'm trying to.
Yeah. So it's interesting if you're thinking of, you know, what you're going to have on your, you know, what's going to be on your gravestone.
Just like I might want one in Latin, even though nobody on the street's going to speak it, or do lots of people speak Greek? Probably the Romans do, but do other people in the marketplace speak Greek to each other?
It is, yeah. I think that what you see is that Greek was itself the lingua franca that went and united all of the various, you know, regions and people groups, etc. Mm-hmm. And so, while you have Aramaic as a more localized language, which is in itself kind of a fossil of the previous empire and is itself closer culturally to Hebrew, Greek is and had been for centuries what had taken over as, you know, as your big major language. And so it's really interesting. The books of Maccabees are, they're really fun illustrations of this because they are both, even though they are written from the standpoint of, hey, we are the Jews and we kicked out all of these terrible, you know, Greek invaders who were trying to go and make us, do all these things. It's interesting because the books themselves are written in Greek. This is 200 years before Christ's time. They're both written in Greek. Now, it's thought that it was probable that First Maccabees had a Hebrew original because it's at least plausible because it has such a Hebrew kind of Greek style.
Wow.
But we don't have any kind of Hebrew or Aramaic originals of it preserved. It's all in Greek. And Second Maccabees is clearly entirely in Greek. It's, you know, it's almost like Greek kind of, you know, epic prose in a sense. And so
that's
even
fantastic.
A couple centuries before Christ's own time, if you were writing anything that was going to have any kind of, you know, broader significance, or even just significance within their own kind of cultural context, as, you know, was predominantly the case for First and Second Maccabees, it was still written in Greek. And so
that's doubly surprising, because I was going to ask you, is the reason the gospel appears in Greek so that it would be more widely read, because it's an evangelical document? Hey, here's the good news. And I want everyone to know it. So I'm going to write it in a language that goes beyond just first century Palestine. But Maccabees is not like that. Maccabees is written for Jews by Jews, isn't it?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, there's very few people who are saying that the books of Maccabees are written for the salvation of all humanity.
Yeah.
And so I think that they're written for the benefit of all humanity, but it's a different kind of thing. It is a pretty localized, national kind of story. And both First and Second Maccabees, are written in Greek a couple of centuries before Christ's own time. So I think you can say, you know, the question that underlies is, well, do these languages, you know, Aramaic, Hebrew, do they live on in any kind of way? If already centuries before, you know, Christ's time, you have what are these very nationalistic stories that are written in Greek? But is there any sort of enduring place that these other languages have if Greek had really taken over culturally as the means of communication, both internally and then, you know, externally? I mean, especially externally. And I think that the answer is yes. It's interesting if, when you go through the writings of Josephus, he goes in his seven books on the Jewish war.
This is a Jewish historian.
That is correct.
Writing in Greek?
So a Jewish historian, about a century after, about a generation after, you know, Christ and the apostles. And so he's writing the Jewish war, I believe in the 90s, detailing the war that went and took place from 66 to 70. And so he's going and writing all this. And it's interesting because he goes and he says in the beginning that he originally composed all of this in Hebrew. And that he then went afterwards and did all of this in Greek so that everybody's going to be able to understand it. And you think, gosh, that's really interesting because we don't actually have a textual history preserved of this at all. But it shows that there is still some kind of significance to, you know, the Hebrew language, the Hebrew identity. And when, and often when it says Hebrew, we don't actually know whether they mean Hebrew or Aramaic because they're so kind of close together.
Script, same community.
Exactly. And what's interesting is you actually have a really similar story told about the Gospel of Matthew, that the Gospel of Matthew was originally written in Hebrew, which again, we don't know if we're talking Aramaic or Hebrew, what's actually here, but there was some original version that was like that. And that it then, you know, the version that we know that gets passed on is the Greek version. And so it's a really interesting historical parallel.
But is that true? Are you convinced by looking at the language philologically that is the case?
It's a really great question. So I would say I'm of two minds on that, because I think the internal evidence would push you in one direction and the external evidence would push you in another direction. I think that the internal evidence from what we have in, you know, the Greek of the Gospel of Matthew, I guess you would say it's strong and clear enough Greek that it seems as though it's not just a sort of word for word translation of an underlying Hebrew text, which you do. And we have lots of examples of that. And when we have really, really Hebrew sounding Greek, we tend to know it when you have something that's very, literalistic in its translation. So the internal evidence would sort of point you against that idea. The external evidence, if we're looking at, you know, early reception, what's, you know, preserved from, you know, the early church fathers and the testimony that happened in those early centuries, this is something that you find early and pretty consistently, that it's said that this is actually, there was something that was here. Wow. And so that would push you in that direction, believe that, you know, there's no real reason that you would go and make that up if it wasn't actually the case. So depending on, you know, honestly, I would say that most biblical scholars who I think tend to be, within the current field, you tend to be more moved by internal evidence than external evidence. If you're leaning, if the primary weight is internal evidence, then you're probably going to say it would seem unlikely that this is a translation of something else. I would say that just the way that I conceive of historical knowledge, when you have something that is early, that's repeated a number of times, I tend to think that that external attestation is significant. Hmm. And so if you were to put some sort of weaponry to my head and say, hey, make a call, tell us, do you think that there was something that was there, some early version of something? I would say, I think probably, okay. I think that there probably was something, but I think that you then have to say that what you see with the internal evidence is not itself reflective of a wooden direct one-to-one translation. And I think that if you're going to look for an analogy with that, you can say there's a lot of other documents where you do have an original Hebrew something. And then when it's actually brought into Greek, it's not trying to do the one-to-one equivalency. It's trying to do something that actually has its own integrity as a Greek writing. And so that to me would be, if there is a Hebrew original to it, that would be the most plausible way to account.
Right. And how would I even go about writing the most important thing that ever happened at a time when I don't have unlike Moses, I don't have my laptop. So I'm going to have to write this down on these, I'm going to make notes. I'm going to write down what I remember. I'm going to circulate it among my friends who all read Aramaic. And then I'm going to say, what do you guys remember this the same? Was that 4,000 or 5,000? Because he said 5,000 and I thought it was 4,000. Yeah. And this guy says 6,000. So you know, and then we're all going to talk about it. And at some point I'm going to commit it to paper. So can you tell, how far back can we see these ideas, the most important, significant thing that ever happened? How did it get committed? Was it paper? Was it skin? Was it papyrus? How far back do we know? How do we think that happened?
Yeah. So, it's interesting when it comes to, methods of composition, things like that. There's a lot that we can say when we get into the later centuries because we have more preserved material evidence. So if you're thinking your second, third, fourth centuries and going on from there, when you're going all the way back to the first century, if you're going to say, hey, what was this actually written on? Who wrote this, that, and the other? You just have less preserved evidence. The place that people usually start is with the writings of St. Paul, because the writings of St. Paul are pretty easy to date. So if you're going to say if you think of, most people will say that Paul's first writings are either first, second Thessalonians or Galatians, depending on, when and where you think Galatians was written and who the audience was. You're most likely getting into either the late 40s or early 50s with those writings. Some people think that those are a bit earlier. But I think that just as far as, what's a kind of standard within the guild to go into date these writings, that's when you have those. And so you have Paul clearly writing letters, and when Paul is writing letters in general, he's not giving you his writings as some sort of initial catechesis, hey, I have great news for you. There is this guy named Jesus. Turns out he was also God. I know that sounds crazy. More information will follow. Tune in for the next episode. what's really interesting is in all of his writings, it takes for granted the existence of Christian communities already. It takes, even of the church itself. It takes these realities for granted. And so already in the 40s and in the 50s, he's writing back and forth to churches addressing, real practical issues. They're going and asking.
These are internal memos for a body of believers that already exists. And we're treating it like I'm supposed to go across time and space to tell new people new things.
Yeah, exactly. And so in some sense, the fact that these documents are what they are is part of why biblical scholarship is interesting, because it would be one thing, if you say, if you're going to take an analogy, if you think of, if you think of Marx was Marx Engels, Communist Manifesto, it's like, you have the writing, it's there. And that writing is, in a sense, itself kind of this generative thing that, other things go and follow from. And I know that it's a little more complicated than that, but you can use that as an analogy and say, here is your early communist kind of thing. They get the whole story straight and they go and send it out. What's really interesting is if you're looking at our earliest Christian writings, that's not really the way that they work, in that Paul is already within a context where you have these churches that are, that are worshiping, that are living, that are clearly stand out by their thought and practice from, the cultural context that they're a part of, both, both Jewish and Greek, and are having to deal with all these kinds of issues. And so there's a sense in which you're hearing one side of a telephone conversation from a historical context where there's already a lot that has happened from, whenever you date the sort of life, death, resurrection of Christ, whether it's 33, whatever. By the time you get to the early 40s, there has been a lot that has gone on.
Yeah.
And so it's remarkable if you think of just, such a small period of time to have this I mean, quite remarkable growth and development. But it's also like, you know, I guess if one reads the book of Acts, that is sort of what you see as well, is that, you know, you've got, you have Pentecost, and then at Pentecost, there's a lot of people that are added to the faith, and, you know, the whole thing escalates fairly quickly. So I think that's actually, in a sense, is corroborated by what you see in our, you know, the earliest letters that we have from the 40s and 50s.
I remember talking to a fellow who was explaining to me that there is an English constitution. It's just not a piece of paper. The English constitution is a living tradition of customs and precedents, and they yeah. refer to it as a constitution, but I'm used to this American one where it says Article 1, Paragraph 1, and so on. So what we're seeing here is a tradition of a church that, you know, the members all understand the rules and the tradition and what they know that's been passed down. So would then like the gospels be, you know, for outsiders? Hey, guess what happened? Or no?
Yeah.
And when would they come?
Yeah. So those are great questions. I would say that I think if you're looking at, so it's easy to overstate this point. You know, C.S. Lewis goes and talks about, you know, how the Gospels themselves are largely actually written for people who already believe and not necessarily, you know, for outsiders. And I think that I would say largely correct. But you wouldn't want to push that too far, because I do think that the Gospels themselves are written evangelistically. And it's interesting because they're actually used evangelistically from a very early date. If you, just a really interesting writing from the early church is the Apology of Aristides, written about 125 by a Christian apologist named Aristides, who's delivering this to the Emperor Hadrian. He's basically saying, hey, here's who Christians are. Here's how what we believe relates to what the Greeks believe, what the Jews believe, what the Egyptians believe, etc. This is actually a more reasonable thing to believe. And so we think you should believe this too. Also, if you want to not kill us, that'd be fantastic. and what's really interesting is there's a number of times in the Apology where he goes and he appeals to the Christian writings, and he tells Hadrian, hey, you can read these for yourselves. Like, you should just read our writings. Just go and read them. And so it's interesting, already in 125 AD, there's a sense that the Christian writings that are present, that they are accessible. They're known. He doesn't even have to go and tell you which ones they are, but he just says, hey, go and take this off. You take these for yourself. And also the expectation that they are going to be intelligible and in some way, you know, effective for those who are reading them, even if they're not necessarily from Christian backgrounds. And so,
you're also implying that there's a accepted body of, you know, a canon that we all agree what's okay and what's in the group and what's not in the group, right? He doesn't have to say, read this one from my friend so and so, but not that one from that guy over there.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think that one can push that argument, I mean, perhaps too far, in the sense that you can have Christian writings as a category without it necessarily being something that is canonically delimited, which is to say, these are the books that are Christian writings. These ones are out. And for a long time, you have Christian writings that are really, really valued that don't themselves go and end up making it into, you know, the canon of scripture, which I think do continue to be valued. I mean, at least I value them. I think they're great.
I bet nobody has read, you know, you biblical scholars and 1% of 1% have read it, but I don't.
Yeah. Well, that's part of what I try to do. I think that the stuff that you get from, you know, the rest of the first century and, you know, going on to the second century, I think the writings that are there are fantastic. Okay. And they're, you know, I think that historically, at least if you're looking at the early centuries, you know, of the church, these writings are also really valued. And even if you regard them as, you know, not necessarily revelation in the sense of there's something normative to them, but something that is still really helpful for interpreting and understanding and applying scripture, I think that these writings are great, and I think they're part of the common inheritance of all Christians. So anyway, that's
right,
just to say.
Right. Just because they're not canonical, that doesn't mean that they're wrong in any way. Nobody says, oh, this is heresy, don't read that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, you can have writings that are heretical, that are that I think self-consciously are doing something different from what the Christianity of, you know, the great church is does and practices. I use the term the great church because it's actually the term that Celsus, who is a pagan critic of Christianity, you know, what he identifies as mainstream Christianity, he calls it, you know, the Christianity of the great church. And so, you know, I think that you do have, you know, Gnostics, other, you know, heretics who go and write things that are, I guess you could say, that are putting things out that are quite, you know, self-consciously going against the received tradition and saying, actually, we have here's a different thing. Here's a different story. We think that all that's wrong. We're going to go a different thing. But something not being canonical does not mean that it's necessarily in that category, because you have tons of writings from the early Christians that are great and hugely valuable, that just don't happen to be part of, you know, what's canonized. And so, anyway, it's helpful to take those as, you know, occasionally overlapping, but definitely non-equivalent categories.
Well, and I just think that there's a real mystery with a capital M here, or a miracle, really, that we kept a cohesive narrative and church through such a time, you know, first through like an underground church and then so many people talking to each other, and yet it all stayed the same. And I find that, I think one could say this is evidence of the Holy Spirit acting among people. Because if I asked you, tell me the story of Robin Hood, I bet you I'll find you 100, if not, a thousand or something like that. Tell me the authoritative version of Batman. You know, he's been around for less than 100 years, but there's so many, you know, people who've spun it and changed it and made it interesting, you know, and with, clearly here somehow there's agreement.
Well, I think that, you know, it comes back to a recognition that something definitive in all of human history had taken place before their eyes, and, you know, and what Christ had done, and then, and the way that that was then transmitted by his apostles. And so I think it comes from that recognition of the definitive character that's there, and why it is that, you know, everything that, you know, everything that he was, you know, kind of recorded has said in these gospels, and then everything that was, you know, written by his apostles that he sent out, why you would have it preserved and copied over and over and over and over and over again, and, you know, valued in the way that it was.
Did that come out with reflection? Because, you know, when we're reading the gospels, clearly nobody sees things. Nobody, you know, everybody's confused about what's going on. What's going on here, Rabbi? Yeah. What's going on here, Lord? But given the time to talk it over after a year, after 2 years, after 3 years, they all came to this conclusion that we now have as the, you know, the foundational creed of the church.
You know, it's interesting because I think each of the four gospels, they each, I think, are clearly telling you the same story and what is recognizable as historically the same story. And at some points you can say, even seem to take for granted that you already know the outline of the story. I think that, you know, most people think that John's gospel, for instance, you know, takes for granted that the, you know, the reader already knows the gospel of Mark and knows the narrative as it's outlined in the gospel of Mark, because, you know, when he introduces characters, for instance, when he introduces, you know, Simon Peter in the beginning, he kind of already assumes that you know who these people are. And so there is, while you have that, and in a sense, there is a kind of coordination, which is, you can recognize, they also, each of these four witnesses are, I think, real independent witnesses. I think that they each, I taught a course on the four gospels this time last year, and they each do their own thing. They each have their own set of eyes that they're seeing with, and they each have, you know, their own tongue that they're going and speaking with, and their own kind of idiom. And each of them is a real author. You know, and you can say, as Catholics, you believe that, scripture is fully human and fully divine, the way that Christ is fully human and fully divine. But it's possible, I think, sometimes to go and to forget that full humanity of the authors, that is something that, God ordained and likes, that each of them, you're going through the Greek, each of them has their own idiom. They have their own style. They have their own way that they write. They're real human beings going and testifying to the word of life that they've gone and encountered. And I just think that's really cool. I love that. The analogy I use sometimes in classes is if you think of some big mountain somewhere, and you think of four people standing north, south, east, and west in relation to it. And then going and writing down and kind of drawing you a picture and describing what it is that they go and see from the kinds of angles that's there. That's kind of what it's like reading the four gospels, and that there's certain things that you see that are kinds of points of emphasis, which is just, from that person's situatedness, there are things about that mountain that they can see that they go and they pull out for you, and it's incredible. And then there might be something else that somebody on the other side goes and sees that you wouldn't have really seen represented much at all, or even necessarily hinted at within the first one, but which is absolutely true in relation to when you're standing on the north side of the mountain, you can see this thing here. And so it's great. It's incredible how you have both of those qualities, both the kind of, again, the continuity, the mutual intelligibility of the four gospels, but also that they all have their own real vantage point and their own real integrity.
That, I love that analogy. I have to interrupt us because my students will be here in a little bit. I'm so grateful to you. I have more questions than I had when we started.
That's fantastic.
And,
That's
I don't fantastic. Know if you, what your schedule's like going forward, if we could do this every week or every month, or
we can do this. We can do this every day as far as I'm concerned.
All right.
I love stuff. So
Matthew Thomas, thank you so much for talking with me today. I've learned so much, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation may be very soon.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Nails, spear shall pierce him through the cross. Be born for me, for you. And hail, hail the word made flesh, the babe, the son of Mary. Chris Odinietz and Matthew Thomas recorded this conversation on Tuesday, January 25th, 2022, the feast of the conversion of Paul. Our music, What Child Is This?, is by Josh and Margot from the band The Great Space Coaster. Find their music at www.gscoasterband.com. The image of the dog, our logo, is from a stained glass window at the monastery of Santo Domingo de Silos in Spain, and is taken with the permission of the Dominican Friars of England, Wales, and Scotland from their website, english.op.org. My name is Chris Odinietz. Please email me with comments, questions, ideas at almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com. Talk to you soon. Son of Mary, this is Christ the King, whom shepherds guard.